Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, April 13th, 2017, and tonight's main topic, I'll be talking about some water issues and diamonds. Diamonds are a comet's best friend. I'll be talking about that. And you may all remember there was a, I think it was a 1950s movie, maybe 60s, it was called Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. Well, tonight's main theme is diamonds are a comet's best friend. We'll talk about that. Some very interesting conditions there. And also about the properties of diamonds. And also I'll first of all start with just a little narrative about the standard source of science of diamonds, that they are formed under high pressure down deep in the ground. And this sounds pretty logical. When I first heard it, I mean, I believed it. I figured, well, somebody must know, because they're found around vents, volcanic vents, and, where supposedly the Earth is coming up from deep in the Earth's center, and that's where they find diamonds. But in a sense, that's not the only place that you find diamonds. You find diamonds, microdiamonds, sprayed, and they're captured in the upper side of, say, mastodons, these woolly mammoth animals that lived prior to the last ice age and died in the last ice age in mass. And you find their upper side just smattered with microdiamonds. Now, this is a very strange thing. And also in my NASCA paper, the second part, which was published recently, which you can get on the webpage, the second part of the NASCA paper talks about microdiamond holes in rocks that are found out in the Nazca Plains. Very interesting phenomenon. But the whole concept of these microdiamonds coming in from outer space at ultra-high velocity, and of course they're little, for them to penetrate the atmosphere, 100 miles of atmosphere, and collide with something and penetrate deep into something that's as hard as a piece of living bone tissue, that's quite a feat. So where do these microdiamonds from outer space come from? How are they formed? What is a diamond? A diamond is basically a carbon structure. Like graphene is a modern carbon structure where you have a six-sided, basically a hexagon. That's a six-sided figure in geometry with six equal sides. The carbon atoms form a hexagon, and then those all link together. And so it's interesting because this is a very stable material, because carbon, all the covalent bonding is associated. It's associated with other atoms and all used up. So there's no room for anything else to happen here. So this is one of the beauties of understanding chemistry. And graphene and diamonds are in the same family, in a sense that they are crystalline structures of the carbon atom. So anyway, I'll be talking more about that and about some water issues. Let me dive into these water issues first of all. This is something I have been working on for a long time. Now, hopefully the new sales page should be up by the time this show airs, something I've been working on for a while, trying to consolidate and make a lot simpler, a lot easier to use the sales page. But here's the situation. I had for sale up on the webpage, it's called a whole house water filter. A whole house water filter takes out, this particular model took out chlorine, and that's a bit offensive for some people to shower in, but you still needed the filtration at the sink to get out all of the other chemicals and toxins, etc. And so in a sense, you would be paying quite a bit of money, but I think it was about $1,400 plus shipping, for a filter that just took out chlorine. And what I have on the market now, it's more of a commercial type of a model. They're quite a bit more expensive. They're up in the $2,500 to $4,000 range. So it's not something everybody's going to get for their house. These are more for commercial use Or the biggest use for these are for people that have farms and ranches, those type of situations. And so if you just have a little hobby farm or you just have a few animals or things like that, the filters that I already sell would be far more than sufficient. Or you say you have one horse, you don't need a high flow rate water filter. But what I have now is just procured. It's just going public right now. Are water filters, two models that have very high flow rates. So, for example, the above and below sink water filters that I sell have a 1 gallon per minute. Now imagine that it's a minute. You take a gallon of, a gallon jug of milk or a gallon container, and it takes 1 minute to fill that container. That's what I currently have. And that's plenty good for the kitchen because you're cooking, you put a pan down there, you put some water in the pan, it takes you about 10 seconds or so. Or you're washing vegetables and you do the initial wash in your regular sink water, and then you do the final wash with filtered water. Or if you're doing sprouts, you fill up, say, a quart jar equivalent size with filtered water to do your sprouting. Okay, well, that's very good. Or if you brush your teeth, if you have a filter in the bathroom, you brush your teeth with that. Okay, that's great. But what if you have a farm where you have a high demand for water and you have big tanks, say it might be a 3,000 to 5,000 gallon tank or something like that, then some people would be just fine with a 1 gallon per minute flow rate, and that would take, say, a 3,000 gallon tank, it would take it about a day and a half to fill. So it's not a problem because the people are not using that much water, and so that's a good alternative. But there's some people, say you have a horse ranch, and you have a lot of horses, you have a lot of cleaning activity that requires filtered water, etc. Or you have a large, say, chicken operation or something like that, and it's organic, but to this point, you've been using unfiltered water. Well, or you have a greenhouse where you're producing commercial quantities of vegetables. Let's say another example. But you're up to this date not using filtered water. In other words, you're claiming organic, but you're putting who knows what kind of chemicals into these plants or into these animals because it's unfiltered. Well, now I have a solution. And it comes in two sizes. One is a 7 gallon per minute model. And that can go up to, let me just look at the specs here, maximum of flow rate of 20 gallons per minute. So that has, these are industrial units. And then the other one, the larger one, can go up to 36 gallons per minute. It has a 3-inch pipe. So these are big industrial units. Let's say the bigger one is 30 inches high and 20 inches in diameter. So, and these take multiple filter elements, and that's where you get the high flow rate. So it's a housing. You can go see them on the webpage. So I just want to inform people that I now have these, and of course I've had for a long time the tanks, that which go from 125 gallons up to 20,000 gallons, and people have purchased these and are very happy with them. They're high standard, highest quality food, water grade plastics, and they're very heavy duty. In fact, I have how many tanks? I've got one of 125 gallons, I got one of 100 gallons, I've got one of 350 gallons, I've got another one of 3,000 gallons. And then I've got two of 500 gallons, and then I've got some other tanks just at various places. Okay, so anyway, I personally use these tanks myself. But the water filters, where you have a need for very clean water, and that means all of the bacteria, the cysts, the toxins, the fluoride, the arsenic, if you're using city water, and or a lot of well water has arsenic in it also. So if you want to get these chemicals out, but you need a high flow rate, and the lifetime for these filter systems, and of course, just like any of the other filter systems, you have to replace the filter elements, but it's the same JMCC GF quality filtration as with all of my other products. I don't sell anything else. Actually, I do sell the old style ceramic filters with just a carbon inside for people who, say, live out in the country and they have no chemicals in their water, etc. But that's pretty rare. I really don't sell many of those. But I'll tell you something, that's that my poorest quality filter, which I sell, and I don't encourage people to buy unless they really know they don't have chemicals, that's the best quality of all my competition. That's just saying a lot, because I'm the only person that has the all-in-one filtration. You don't need anion filters and all of that. It's all-in-one filter. So anyway, I just want to make people aware of this, that these new industrial-grade filters are now available on the webpage along with the tanks. So say you have a farming operation, milk cows or other, you know, there's all kinds of needs for water on the farm, filtered water. And if you are claiming to be organic or you want to be organic and you want your the house to have clean filtered water, this would be a good way to do it. So you could have all of your farm water filtered. And remember, this takes out really everything, leaves the beneficial minerals go through, and you're doing this with filtration. And once you have your operation set up, this is going to last you a lifetime. And so you have the big tanks, you filter the water before you put it in the tank, and then you have on-demand tank water, 3,000 gallons, 5,000 gallons, 125 gallons if you want something that small, or up to 20,000 gallons. Anyway, just go on the webpage, and it's a little bit of an advertisement, but I'm really proud of getting this into my product line. So just in review, I've got the stainless steel water filters. I have the GF filter elements that nobody has anything like that. I have the high-density polyethylene large filter, water filter, gravity feed. That is the biggest one on the market. Nobody has anything that big. We'll filter up to 100 gallons a day. Plus, with the Imperial filters, it would filter even more. Then I've got, of course, the Imperial filters, which nobody else has, the double diameter, four times the lifetime, two times the flow rate. And then I've got the above sink and below sink water filters for inline. Then I've got these new high pressure, large industrial units and the tank systems. Plus I have my travel 1 and 2 liter travel filters, which are for traveling. And they're, I invented these myself, and I use them. I travel with these. I wouldn't leave home without one. And then, of course, the pre-filter, which is my design product that is used to pre-filter water. Some people use it all the time. And then some people use it, have it in case of emergency, so they can filter stream or pond water, things like that. And sure, you can take and dump sludgy water into your water filter, but believe me, you don't want to do that. If you're going to have a situation where you have really sludgy water, you do not want to pour it in your nice, clean, stainless steel or plastic water filter. You want to pre-filter. And that's the whole idea, is you get the bulk of the junk. It's called the oil, the ChemRad oil. So the chemical radiation oil pre-filter to get all of that out in case of emergency. Okay, enough of that. But just check that out on the webpage, jmccsci.com. Now, a word about the paid cast and what's going on right now. I'm concentrating on the Cosmos series that I'm right in the middle of this. I'm moving along. It's going to take me till about the end of July to complete this, doing weekly episodes. And then, of course, every month I have a Tesla's Mind episode. But here's what I'm doing. I want to explain this, and it's a very important part of my historical record. In 1980, Carl Sagan was the main spokesperson for science. He got that because he had dumped on Velikovsky, led the charge, organized the science world to have consistent beliefs relative to the origin of the solar system. All other sciences fell in line, rank and file. So finally, there was an organized set of laws or rules or beliefs relative to science? Well, it turns out that almost everything he said in the Cosmos series, which was 13 episodes long and highly viewed, 600,000 viewers, 600 million people worldwide have seen this, allegedly, that's the count. And the book that came out of it, Cosmos, was the number one selling science book of all time. So believe me, this was serious, serious promotion, serious fanfare, and with Carl Sagan being the smartest man in the world. Only problem is, almost everything he said in there was wrong. it makes me just cringe when I, in fact, as part of my doing this production I'm doing, it's what I, my production is called Cosmos, The Real Story. And the Sagan's was Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, was the kind of subtitle of his Cosmos series. In 2014, just a couple years ago, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the curator of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, he's an astrophysicist and a spokesperson also for the standard science community, redid the Cosmos series at the request of Anne Druyan, who is Carl Sagan's second wife, who produced and co-wrote the Cosmos series with Carl Sagan back in the 1980s. Now, a little historical note, when I was at Cornell University in 1979 to 81, some people asked me, it was what, Daniel on Joyce Riley's show yesterday, asked me if I had met Carl Sagan. And I said no, because he was not on campus very much when I was there. He was not actively teaching at Cornell during the 2 years when I was there, taking in all of the data from around the solar system and developing my work, the electrical nature of the solar system. That's where I coined the term electric universe. It's in my papers, in the summary of my papers. That's where that term comes from. But basically the plasma discharge comet model, the capture system of solar system formation, the sun with the electric field generated by excess current of protons in the solar wind, the induced electric dipole redshift, which shows that the Big Bang did not happen, and that the redshifts we're seeing from galaxies and quasars is due to internal non-uniform electric fields around these fusion-based objects. So anyway, Carl Sagan was not at Cornell. He was believing he was already had all the knowledge in the world, but oddly enough, before we had really sent out spacecraft to visit comets, we had spacecraft going to Jupiter and Saturn during that time, but Carl missed the whole show. The real show was at Cornell University, where he was David Duncan, chair of astronomy, which is a high, you know, when you have a chair, that's like a honorary position. And so anyway, but back to the Cosmos series, pretty much everything Carl said in the Cosmos series is patently false. It does not add up. And so what I do is I use the talking points of the Cosmos series. And I say it's unfortunate. I have to sit and watch these, and I just about gag when I'm watching these, because he says it with such authority and such assuredness. And like I say, it's very clear that literally everything he's talking about is incorrect. And there's a lot of omissions, a lot of things they don't talk about. For example, a couple episodes ago, I talked about evolution and all the flaws in evolution. And so I think you should join the paid cast so you can listen to these. But here's the point. I'm doing this for a reason. I encourage people to listen to the paid casts, to read my books, and study my work, because this is an educational tour. This is not, in fact, one of my criticisms of Carl Sagan and deGrasse Tyson is that what they are doing is Hollywood production scientific entertainment. And I don't do that. I get down to the nuts and bolts of real science. I don't whisk over it and pretend like it's, this is all known, this is all proven, and therefore all we got to do is give you the results, and then you honor Sagan and deGrasse Tyson like the most intelligent men in the world. The problem also is that what they're expounding is tier two science, what I call tier two fairy tale science. And so it's important because they set the precedent. They set the talking points and of what is important in astronomy, astrophysics, space science, and also evolution, for example, which covers a lot more than just space science and astronomy. They're talking about the evolution of man and species, etc. But there's some problems with evolution. There's some problems with dark matter and the Big Bang, or the Oort cloud, supposedly a place where comets formed and where they come from. And a lot of the things that they depend on are based on ice balls, comets being ice balls or snowy conglomerates, and that's simply not true. So anyway, what I'm saying is that it's very important for me to go through this whole series of Cosmos and then give the real story. So this is very important. And then when I'm done with this, by July, I should be done with this series. I'm going to can it in a package, and then it will be a package. But you can get this in the paid cast along with all the other talks that I give just by joining the paid cast. So that's on my website. And also I have other series in the paid cast, which will be packaged at a certain point, like Tesla's Mind. I do an episode of Tesla's Mind, and back in October, I did three episodes of Tesla's Mind talking about the major weapons of Tesla. So very important. The paid cast is very important, and I do a lot of scientific work on this show to support it. Like tonight, I'll be talking about diamonds and carbon structures, the basic formation of crystals and molecules, etc., from the carbon atom, which is, by the way, they call this carbon-based life, and that's the basis of the carbon chains, which build up the nucleotides, which build up the DNA, which are the information pieces that guide our production. And that's a whole very interesting topic in itself. So I'll be talking mainly about carbon-only crystals in tonight's main science topic. Also, I want to mention that when I'm on other shows, etc., this is what you expect, but they put up a lot of water filter ads, and I get to listen to these. I don't, you know, always get to listen to everybody else's radio show, but when I'm guest, I'm listening to the commercials that you would hear during the breaks, when I'm on break. And the claims that come out from water filter companies are incredibly amazing. And I really don't even know where they get this, like people saying that their filters last for 5 years. Well, sure, if you don't use them, but that they would last for 5,000 or 6,000 gallons, it's simply not true. And one of the things that I'm very specific about is the testing that goes on for my filters. They're tested to NSF National Certification Standards, and end of story. And they're tested for the lifetime of the filtration. So that's a second part of the testing that a lot of people don't go through. I call it the 50-gallon test, the 5,000-gallon claim. Because when you look at the fine print on any testing that has been done on the other filters, what you find is they have a 50-gallon run for their testing. And in fact, if you took a 20 pieces of paper out of your printer and ran water through them, they would probably do just about as good a job of filtering for the first 50 gallons. But it's after that when the rubber meets the road, when the real story is told. So the claims that are out there, unfortunately, with water filtration, but there's also a lot of many things that they don't tell you, like they all require you to buy arsenic fluoride add-on filters, because their filters don't take out arsenic and fluoride like mine do, all in one. Anyway, I have to say this on the air because not being specific about any other brand, because only my filters are all in one. It's the only product on the market where you take out all of the toxins, everything, including arsenic and fluoride, all in one filter element. And they're designed to take out, what we did was we went out and said, what are all the pollutants that you could find in water? And we target all of those. So all of them are taken out, and we don't target the beneficial minerals, so they pass through. It's this is light years ahead of the competition. Anyway, my biggest selling product is replacement filters, where people bought a filter from someplace else. They have the container, and they want the top-of-the-line filter elements. That's my biggest selling product, are replacement filter elements, bar none. And I have the 10 packs. Okay, enough discussion of that, but water is really important. I'm just going to give you this one little anecdote. I talked to a woman this past week who is beginning to go on a health kick. Now, I don't know how old she is. I assume that, you know, she's, you know, more than a teenager, more than, say, 20 or 25 years old. But, you know, she decided to go on a health kick. So the first thing she wants to do is drink clean water. And so you should drink a lot of clean water. And I mentioned that there are doctors, when people come sick to their office, the first thing they do is they make them drink clean water. They start them on a regimen of drinking clean water. So you need a filter that's actually taking out all of the toxins. A lot of the filters don't take out all of the toxins. In fact, there's some that inject a herbicide into their filters to stop them from creating mold. In mine, we put a micro silver recognized agent of pure silver into the filters to stop them from growing bacteria. And I've seen, I'll tell you, I've seen filters that you can get from Korea for $7 on Alibaba, and people are selling them for $200. I'm just shocked and amazed, but that's the reality. You get these made in the China and foreign country. That's the other thing. My filters are all made in our own factory in the United States under quality control, under tested to national certification standards all the time. So there's, it's amazing what the filters that are made in foreign countries, and then really for pennies, and they're trying to sell them for $200 or $250 or something like that. I'm just in shock. By the way, I mentioned I was on Joyce Riley yesterday, my monthly visit, and Daniel over there doing the interview, and we talked a bit about Syria and Korea. So you may want to listen to those shows too, the Power Hour. The second hour would be 8 to 9 o'clock Central Time, Power Hour, Joyce Riley. And yesterday, that would have been the 12th of April. So you may want to give a listen there. So I won't repeat anything on those particular topics. Also, I just wanted to make mention of the DVDs that I have in my site, the DVD 1 and 2, the historical DVDs that go back to the 1980s, where you'll see me as a much younger person and then progress up to the current date. So anyway, I'm sorry, just one other issue. The paid cast is now, the upgrades for the paid cast are at half priced. So these prices were getting up their ways, like the full set of ebooks was like close over $100, plus all of the back issues going back to last August of the paid cast. And so, or the upgrade for the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. All of the upgrades are at half price, and that's a limited time offer. I want to encourage people to go to the paid cast. So the paid cast upgrades, if you want just the monthly, it's $3.95 a month, but I encourage people to get all of the episodes back to last August, or plus the upgrades where you get my book library, etc. And so the upgrades are at half price, so you save a lot of money there. And the webpage, jmccsci.com. Off to the world of carbon crystals, crystalline carbon structures. So this talks about graphene, diamonds, and other crystalline structures, including the carbon atom. So let's take a little bit of a trip into the world of diamonds. Diamonds, of course, are the world's most precious gem. Not only that, but that they're the one of the hardest materials known. And so micro diamonds and diamond chips are used on saw blades. So if you want to cut something really, 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 the hardest materials known, you would use a diamond-tipped saw. And so what they do is I don't know how they attach them. That's a good question. But they attach the little micro diamonds to the tip of the saw. And so the cutting edge literally are small micro diamonds and are very small chips of diamond. But what is a diamond? Okay, to understand what a diamond is, let's take a square cube, a cube that is equal on all sides, like the little kid's toy, you know, the building blocks cubes. Okay, now let's put an atom of carbon in the middle of each side. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 carbon atoms. You take one of the sides, which is a square, you put a carbon atom right dab in the middle on all six sides. Okay, so that's the beginning of the diamond crystal. Okay, secondly, you take a carbon atom and put it all corners of the cube. So every corner of the cube has a carbon atom. That's the second grouping of carbon atoms. And so now we have six sides, and when we have eight corners, so that's 14 carbon atoms associated with our cube. And now let's go into the middle of the cube, and we'll place some other carbon atoms, and that'll complete the diamond structure. Okay, this is a little more complicated visually, so I'm going to try and explain this. Let's take the cube and set it down on the desk, but let's get your eye down at cube level. So you're looking right into one of the faces of the cube. So remember, we got a diamond, or we have a carbon atom at all the corners, and then we have a carbon atom at the center of all of the sides, right in the center of all of the sides of the cube. That's where, so far, we have 14 carbon atoms. Now let's take two opposing corners on the side that's closest to you. Pick those out. Okay, there's two corners, and of course there's two carbon atoms there. And there's a carbon atom right between them in the middle. Okay, so now let's go over to the other side of the cube. And first of all, look at the same corners, but on the opposite side. But don't choose those, choose the other two corners. So it's flipped 90 degrees. So you take those two corners, and there's a carbon atom right in the middle of those on the other side. So we have two sides. We have the close side of the cube, and we have the far side of the cube. On the close side, you pick two corners that are opposite, and there's the carbon atom in the middle, and then you go over to the other side. You pick the opposite corners and the atom in the middle. Now what we're going to do, come over back to the close side. You've got the two corner atoms, the middle one. Go inwards, back to the center, go inwards, and back to the other corner. Okay, so we're going to start at one corner, go into the cube, into the inner part of the cube, and then come back to the center. Then go into the cube again, into the center of the cube, and then come back to the center. It makes kind of like an M shape or a W if you look at it upside down. And now go to the other side and do the same thing. And all of these atoms then connect to the closest atoms in the structure. That leaves four corner atoms that are not attached to anything. They're going to be used to attach to the next crystal cell. And now what have we formed here? We've formed an extremely strong, unbendable structure. That's diamond. And once again, when you have carbon, if you've accounted for all the valence electrons, there's no other way for any other atom to get in here and attach by any other means. There's no covalent bonding electrons available. And so, okay, I've already talked about graphene, which is a graphite, which is another form of graphene. What graphene is it's a single layer of these hexagonal structures, crystalline structures, but a single layer of them. Graphite, like the pen that you write with, that's graphite, that's a form of carbon, is another structure, but those are multiple layers of carbon. And but anyway, these are two structures which are very different. Like the graphite on your pen is like a powder form. In fact, you can buy graphite powder in one of the common uses that you put it to use in locks. You squirt it into a lock or something that needs a very super fine lubricant. And so a lock is a good example. You put the key in the lock, the tumblers are there, the little pins on springs that have to come down, and they're very little and they work in very small places. And so you have to get something in there. The problem with using an oil is actually an oil is too big, it's too viscous, etc., for such a little teeny space. And so they use graphite. Graphite gets down to the atomic level into a powder that's so fine it's down at the atomic level. So it becomes an excellent lubricant for low temperature applications where you need something that's just a super, super, super fine lubricant. Okay, so carbon in this form has some very interesting properties. But back to the idea, where do diamonds come from? Now, let's look at this theory that they're made in the center of the earth under tremendous pressure. And you think, oh, gee, it's got to be a lot of pressure down there, a lot of heat. Remember the Superman movie? Superman, this is not a recent Superman movie. I don't know, maybe they've included this. But back in the early days of Clark Kent in the TV series Superman, there's one episode where he has to make this diamond. So somebody gives him a piece of like charcoal from your charcoal briquette, the old-fashioned charcoal barbecue, gives it to Superman. He takes it in his hand and he crushes it. And when he opens up his hand, out comes a diamond, perfectly formed and cut with all its facets, etc. Very interesting that he not only made the diamond by pressure in his hand, but he also cut all the facets in his hand to make a diamond. Okay, so anyway, that's not where diamonds come from, I don't think. But let's look at this idea of a diamond being formed deep in the earth under high pressure. Well, if the diamond is the hardest material around, then all the other material around it is softer. It's less sturdy, let's put it that way. It's not as strong as the diamond. So how do you get the pressure to create the diamond in deep in the ground when all the material around the diamond is softer? See, it doesn't make any sense if you look at it, just like everything else in fairy tale standard science. And then the theory is that the diamonds, which were made deep, 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 deep down in the earth, come up through some kind of movement in volcanic channels and come up to the surface of the earth and are deposited there, and that's where you find diamonds. Well, let's step back a minute. It doesn't make any sense because we would find diamonds typically around any place where there was a volcano. And that's really not the case. There's only a couple places where you have deposits of diamonds on Earth. And so anyway, there's something else missing here. And so we have a concept of moraines. Moraines are areas on the planet that are not associated with the geology around them. It's a French name. And you have, for example, out in Montana, you might have an area which is geologically very different than all of the surrounding geological structures, and so you call that a moraine. So the diamonds you would find in a moraine-type region, in other words, it went through different development, and it's now up at the surface, and a lot of the moraines were developed deep down in the ground, but then came up at a later time, or the opposite, the surrounding ground was deeper down in the earth and then came up at a later time. But at any rate, the moraine is a separate type of structure. So it's not unusual to find areas of Earth that are very different than the surrounding regions, and thus the region where you find diamonds. But let's look, just go into outer space, and this comes back to my opening monologue where I was talking about diamonds are a comet's best friend. Now, going back to the idea that the mastodons have been sprayed, like you took a spray of high-velocity diamonds and sprayed that entire area, and of course you don't find them in the dirt. They've been washed away with the rain and the water, etc. But the mastodons, and this is common up in Alaska, say for along the riverbeds, where they find the remains of mastodons all smashed up when there was a flash flood up there, which was at the same time when the entire herd of mastodons went extinct. Well, guess what, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas and everybody else? The cause of the Great Ice Age was a passing comet, where we spent time in the vicinity of a very large comet. In the glaciers were due to the fact that we had a large influx of water, and additionally, that we lost sunlight. The comet, for a period of as many as, like in the Noah's flood, we know that the sun was blotted out for a period of 40 days and 40 nights. And it went dark, and we had this tremendous storm, a huge influx of water that basically flooded the entire world. And when the waters receded, the ocean level had risen anywhere estimated between 200 and 600 feet in, you know, that the ocean level had risen. And when you look at the topography of the continents, you look, you can do this, it's Google Map will show you, look for underground or underwater topography, and you see the continental shelves all around the world, which basically were shallow basins with the ocean eroding them for who knows how long. But the continental shelves, the water used to be down below those. And those used to be the regions that the ocean used to be below those levels. Okay, so the glaciation, the eruption of 75% of the volcanoes on Earth all at one time, the influx of water which created the glaciers, etc., and the demise of the dinosaurs where they died a violent death with a lot of death and destruction. Also, the human race went through this, and we know this, we have heard about this, the Colbran talks about it. Okay, but what does this have to do with comets and diamonds? Well, it's very simple. Let's talk a little bit about snowflakes. Snowflakes were a mystery. How did they develop? How did a snowflake develop? And so people tried forming vacuum chambers with water vapor, trying to recreate the conditions in clouds in a vacuum chamber, or not in a vacuum chamber, but in an enclosed chamber. And they could never quite get the crystals to form. They could form ice crystals, but they were long and odd-shaped, and they couldn't get this beautiful, symmetrical, six-sided figure. And these, of course, are made up of water molecules, which have a lot of properties that have that's a lot like carbon. They make crystalline structures. They make amorphous crystalline structures. And then they make non-amorphous crystalline structures, which are really crystals like diamonds. They're structured and have repeating shapes, repeating structure in the crystalline structure. So the end result is that one time a scientist, they put an electric field on a pinhead that was in their chamber, and they brought the conditions right for making snow, and lo and behold, there they were, the six-sided snowflakes forming on the tip of a pinhead that had an electric field. So what does that have to do with diamonds? Well, it turns out that the same type of experiments were done in vacuum by taking and vaporizing carbon. So you had just a cloud of vaporized carbon in a vacuum chamber, and then they sent in through electrodes into the chamber an electron beam. And lo and behold, two things happened. And I have pictures of these on my webpage to give you an illustration. There was a carbon structure that formed, and these I call Buckey structures after Buckminster Fuller. He was the one that popularized these and made the Buckminster Fuller domes, the Buckey domes, or the geodesic domes. That's another term that are used. These are copied after the structures that come out from carbon being bonded in a basically a big spherical structure, but with nothing inside. It's hollow inside, but extremely, extremely strong, an amazingly strong structure. And remember that carbon fiber, this material that golf club shafts are made out of and airplane parts, all kinds of tremendously structural parts are made out of carbon fiber. It's another form of carbon, but I don't want to get into that. That's a bit more complicated. Getting back to the concept of diamonds, this is something that I put together, 2 and 2 equals 4, so to speak. But the way then that they produced artificial diamonds, it's very common now, is they put a vapor of carbon atoms in a vacuum chamber. They put in an electric current of electrons. It forms the Buckey spheres, and inside, the carbon atoms go inside and form the diamond structures. And the reason you need the Buckey sphere is because diamonds form under very high pressure. And it's literally the Buckey sphere that gives it the ability to hold that while the diamond is forming under extremely high pressure in a vacuum chamber. So what do you have? You have a vacuum, you have carbon atoms, and an electron beam. And guess what the plasma discharge comet model talks about in the front on the nose side of comets? The exact same thing. So what do you have? You have an electron beam coming out from the sun, not just any electron beam, it's a tremendously powerful electron beam. You have carbon atoms that are coming in from the space environment and a vacuum. Exactly the conditions you need to make diamonds. So where do you think all the microdiamonds came from that splattered all over the mastodons and also other animals around the world that died during this mass extinction? Isn't that interesting? Now, another little bit of the history of diamonds, that in outer space, now astronomers have looked out and they've looked around stars. And like other materials, diamonds give off a characteristic spectrum. And so you can tell if you see a diamond in outer space. And so they have actually discovered rings, entire rings of diamonds moving around stars and other star systems. And how do those get there? Well, gee, if a comet came in and acted around that solar system for a period of time, then you would have the mechanism to form those diamond rings in outer space around the star. It all makes perfect sense if you understand that a comet, the plasma discharge comet model, is correct. And believe me, you ain't going to get those out of a dirty snowball. Not any way in, you know, any place. So, end result is that diamonds form in outer space. Now, isn't that interesting compared to the standard theory where they grow underground under super high pressure and then they got to make their way all the way up to the surface, not just one of them, but lots of them, to form the banks where we find and discover diamonds in the world today? It's a lot easier to believe that they would have come in from outer space, dumped on a certain area, and there are certain moraines or patches of ground that were susceptible or available to the incoming spray of diamonds that came in from large comets. Now, in a small comet, you're going to get little teeny micro diamonds. With big comets, you're probably going to get much bigger comets. And that's one of the things that it's hard to imagine that we, all the various conditions and that would make large diamonds, small diamonds, etc. But as with probably any other process, there's probably many more small diamonds than big diamonds, just from looking at the statistics of diamonds. And this is something that is going to need some further research. So kids, if you're out there listening to this, you got to understand there's a lot of things we don't know. These are the basics. How do diamonds form? They form in electric fields with electron current in a vacuum with rich in carbon atoms. That's just, you know, that's now a fact. That's in fact how they make artificial diamonds industrially. The other situation is that most diamonds, the way you tell a diamond apart, now you have this beautiful crystalline structure, but how do you tell diamonds apart if they're all built up of this repeating crystalline structure? Well, as it turns out, once you cut the diamond, and I have pictures on the webpage showing how as you form these diamond structures, and I have the facets, how do you cut a heart or a princess shape or any of these other shapes of diamonds, they're cut along the fracture lines or the facets of the crystalline structure. So you, in fact, a diamond cutter doesn't really cut the diamond. They take like a chisel, basically a micro chisel, and they give it a bump and it breaks along that fracture. And that's why the diamond takes on these certain shapes. And that's because the fissures go down the line or the rows that are formed in the crystalline structure. And so you get all of these various shapes. And a expert in diamonds would know how to put the chisel just right to get every facet out of the diamond and have a beautiful, you know, heart-shaped or all of the different shapes that you find diamonds, cut diamonds. But how do you tell one diamond from the other? And in fact, most of the raw diamond is lost in the cutting process. But down deep in the side inside of every diamond, there's coloration because of impurities. But the key factor is that there are fractures. There are fractures because it looks like something that these things impacted something with such force that they fractured. Like literally every diamond has a set fractured pattern. And if you take a picture of that with a microscope, then you can tell that diamond is unique, and that is bound inside the structure of the diamond. So that particular diamond is unique. There's no two diamonds that are perfectly exactly alike. Even though you might cut them, they might be the exact same size, they might be the same cut, they might have the same levels of impurities or the various levels of clarity, etc. But down inside every diamond are fractures. Now, where did those fractures come from? Well, it would seem to make sense that if you impacted these diamonds at high velocity as they came in from outer space and they impacted the Earth, that they would fracture, because in the diamond making process, in a sense, there's no real impacting force that would cause the fractures. Where would that come from deep down inside the Earth? The whole deep down inside the Earth story to me doesn't make any sense at all. But people would never, you know, and if I were living 50 years ago or 100 years ago, I would never imagine the diamonds, the hardest object, the hardest material known to man, came from outer space. No, I would have classified you somewhere close to the loony bin, frankly. But now that diamonds are actually produced by that method, snowflakes are produced by that same method, with an electric field, with electric currents, and they're from outer space. This is a very strange twist. And now, you know, you can't fault all of science for coming up with these theories. I mean, they were doing the best they could at the time. But it's time to start changing things around where we understand the electrical processes that happen in outer space and the end results. And put this together also with the fact that the mastodons are splattered with microdiamonds. Well, gee, if you can associate that with a comet, isn't that a telltale signature that the mastodons in the river overflowing, in the flooding, and all of the other catastrophic events that went along with the Holocene, demise of the mastodons, the saber-toothed tiger, the woolly mammoths, and the entire laundry list, the giant sloth, etc., all of these animals, and almost the human race, that this all occurred at the hand of a comet. Very interesting. Just a little bit about graphene. It's a newly discovered material. It's a single layer of graphite, and it has very interesting properties. It's conductive. It conducts heat very well, which is characteristic of a conductor. And it can be used for, they're using it for batteries. They're using it for capacitors, supercapacitors. There's all kinds of applications that are coming along for graphene, and I suspect, I would venture to say, that we have not discovered 99% of the uses of graphene. A single layer of carbon atoms in a hex pattern, and then layering them up, and then creating other patterns. I know they're looking at computer-like functions, gates and transistor-like functions for microcomputer type of applications. So all of this coming down the line, very interesting. But where do diamonds come from? Like I say, if you would have told me this 10, 20 years ago, I would have put you off in the category of somebody ready for the loony bin. But no, that's what's going on. That's an actual situation. It's proven in the laboratory, and it's actually an industrial process. But what nobody has done, except for me, of course, is associate this with the processes that go on in comets. And so if you imagine there are comets around other solar systems that are immense, there are comets that have come through our solar system that are immense and the cause of severe devastation, not only to planet Earth, but other planets. I just have a minute here left. I see one of the other false claims I hear on the radio shows about water filters. One brand calls itself the original. There's only one original brand on the planet. It's the Dalton. I used to sell Daltons, a very good brand, but I don't sell those anymore. What I'm selling now, I believe, are far superior because they're the all-in-one filters. And the Daltons simply don't have that, but Daltons, I sold them, and I'm not going to say anything bad about the competition, but the literal truth is that the Daltons are the originals. Those are from John Dalton back in the 1800s in England, etc. That was the original water filter and the ceramic water filters, etc. And then everything branched out from there. In fact, the people who call themselves original didn't start until into the maybe late 1990s into the early 2000s. And so not exactly original. So you like I say, you find all of these claims out there. I suggest that if you want to understand water filters, go to my webpage, read the spec sheets, and understand. I have a comparison chart there, etc. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.